Welcome to Ida History, the show that digs up the most thought-provoking stories from Idaho's history. Here are your hosts, Jeff Wade and Mark Iverson.
That's right. This is Ida History. I'm your host, Jeff Wade, sitting with my Wild West co-host, Mr. Mark Iverson. Mark, are you going to do something about it, or are you just going to stand there and bleed?
I think I'm going to put a Band-Aid on my alley, Jeffrey.
Honestly, with all the bacteria and stuff in the Old West, that's probably a good idea.
Right. Yeah. We're going to get to some good stuff today. I think we haven't really, well, we've touched upon the Old West for sure. It's like, what do you consider the Old West? But like the Wild West, you know, we're going to get into the Wild West today because we're going to, you know, talk about one of the greatest, if not the greatest, badass of the West of all, like lawmen. At times, he was actually a lawbreaker. But we're going to talk about Wyatt Earp. We'll actually be talking about his time after, what he became famous for, you know, the shootout at the OK Corral. But, so we're more specifically going to talk about his time as a miner in Eagle City, not the one in which I am currently sitting, down by Boise, but it was a boom town founded in 1882 after prospector Andrew J. Pritchard struck gold near there on April 25th, 1882. And though Pritchard and his men, you know, had only found gold tailings before, it was this strike that led to this great stampede. And so we're going to talk about Wyatt and his time tied to, you know, the Coeur d'Alene mining district and Eagle City.
That's a good summary. But first, before we get into the meat of this wiki Wild West episode, why don't we do a couple announcements real quick, Mark? Tell us what's going on September 25th.
Our book, it's not quite a tome, you know, maybe 128 pages, but it's our second book that's coming out with or through the History Press. They're calling it Haunted Boise, and we're cool with it. Well, it's coming out for purchase, and we're excited about it, and has lots of interesting stories, some lesser known than others.
There's a couple that probably no one's ever heard of in here, so I'm excited for people to read this one. And I told you my favorite, I think yesterday, my favorite story in there is one that probably no one has heard unless they happen to have read that Stateson's article from way back when.
Yeah, give us a hint, Jeff.
Oh, the 8th Street Entity.
Oh, yeah. That is a good one. We know right where that is, though, you know, the building itself is probably or is long gone. But there's another old building located right next to it, and I think people enjoy reading about that one. I don't want to give away too much.
Definitely. It's a wild story. Probably one of the craziest hauntings I've ever heard of, and I live and breathe paranormal stuff. So,
right. It is fun. Speaking of that, on October 28th, we are doing something rather new for us, but exciting.
Oh, yeah. We've been invited to an event. It's out the balcony, right?
I believe so, yeah. And it sounds like a lot of fun to participate in and to watch.
What's the name of the event?
Lectures by Lushes. And so basically, you know, you just get up on stage, you do a PowerPoint, you get kind of... You get an hour beforehand to get buzzed, you know, and if you so choose, and a lot of people I hope choose, and then you present on some sort of funny, creepy, this one's for Halloween, so maybe a little bit of both that we're going to talk about. You and I have a couple we've kind of narrowed down, but we have to choose.
Yeah, so it's like basically drunk history meets a classroom presentation. Hopefully our audience is a little drunker than we are, though. I don't know.
I hope so. But it sounds really funny and fun. And it's going to be on October 28th, just before Halloween. And I guess the last two of these, the arranger, organizer, he told us that two of them have sold out and he's done three. So that's really cool.
Very cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, we'll be there. And then, I think that's it. Oh, we're going to take a break after this episode. What we've been doing as far as episode releases, we've been doing 6 in a row and then taking 2 weeks off to kind of recoup and, refocus. Obviously it's a lot of work putting these episodes together. So we need to take a little break here and there. Right, Mark?
I think so, because we have lots of other stuff we're working on, you know. I mean, content that you can get online from us, and you know, new tours, and you know, updating our whole, I guess, system. We're always evolving and on the move, and so we're trying to turn out the best product we can, which is what we're always trying to do, and we're always learning. So, yeah, we're going to be busy.
That is correct, sir. All right, you ready to talk about WADERP?
I sure am, Jeff.
All right, so we're talking about the time period after the shootout at the OK Corral, which was, you know, pretty famous, I suppose, right? I think there was a movie about it with Val Kilmer.
Yeah, Val, I mean, he totally was the coolest, in my opinion. But, you know, I mean, Kurt Russell ain't bad, man. He's not shabby.
True. But that happened on October 26, 1881, in the streets of Tombstone, Arizona Territory.
You know, Wyatt didn't make it to the Idaho Territory until 1884. You know, and that wasn't that long after his legendary ride of vengeance, you know, his vendetta ride, as they called it, you know, going out to hunt down the killers of his brother Morgan, you know, and also for those that maimed his brother Virgil Earp's left arm.
You know, there's something about these Earp brothers in general. Like, obviously, they're cut from the same cloth because they're brothers, but it's like a different cloth than, you know, anyone else. Like, these dudes are pretty badass, right? They all proved to be tough men in a scrape, and they all worked hard to improve their positions in life.
You know, right, yeah. They'd kill you if they had to, you know, but by and large, they didn't seem to be the ones to, you know, start the fighting. Virgil Earp himself was a respected lawman, as was Morgan Earp. And they, along with the infamous Doc Holliday, he's like that anti-hero. That's why everybody loves him. He's kind of like the criminal and the savior, the hero at the same time, you know. But Doc had stood by Wyatt's side in the shootout at the OK Corral. Warren Earp, the youngest brother, he rode with Wyatt in 1882 to hunt down Morgan's killers. His other brothers, Newton, James, and then also Virgil, they had all fought in the Civil War for the Union while Wyatt had tried to join up, but he was escorted home by his father instead. And so all these dudes had some real backbone and metal, is what I'm saying. True badasses.
So Wyatt Earp came from Monmouth, Illinois, where he was born on March 19th, 1848, to Nicholas and Virginia Ann Earp. He had three older brothers, Newton, Wyatt's half-brother and eldest of the siblings, followed by James and Virgil.
Wyatt also had an older sister, but she died at the age of 10 when he was 7 or 8 years old in Pella, Iowa, after the family moved there when Wyatt was 2. And this was so Nicholas Earp could claim a land grant that he had earned as a soldier fighting in the Mexican-American War. And this is kind of crazy, but it's kind of funny, too. He wasn't shot. He wasn't sorted or bayoneted or whatever. He was kicked in the bullocks by an angry horse, and then he had to muster out. You know, that sounds like it hurt.
Yeah, well, you know, good thing he was facing away from the horse, or he probably would not have had so many kids later on.
Right, man.
But as we mentioned before, Newton, James, and Virgil all fought for the Union, as any true son of Illinois would, you know, home state of Abraham Lincoln, right? But Wyatt was too young to enlist in the army. Around the age of 15, he tried to join up, but his father got word of the boy's intentions and intercepted Wyatt before he could attempt to enlist.
Newton and James were severely injured during the war, but eventually they recovered, and by 1864, the Earps headed west from Iowa. In Omaha, Nebraska, Wyatt had witnessed his first killings. Two men at the same time, that is. They were shooting it out in the street, and both ended up killing each other at the same moment. And he said, you know, for a man who would experience all this violence later, he said that the sight made him sick.
Along a trail to California in the Wyoming Territory, the wagon train that the Earps were members of witnessed one of the group's hunters, a man named Chapman, returning from a hunt to get captured by natives around 500 yards away from the wagons. He was killed and scalped as they watched. Wyatt had already watched three men die just months after leaving Iowa.
Yeah, imagine packing up the old minivan and traveling from the Midwest out to California to see you know, Mickey and company out there at Disneyland. Before you get there, you see a dude on the side of the road or the interstate, you know, jumped on, slaughtered, and then dismembered. You know, can you imagine just leaving your front door and then all of a sudden you're in the like Mad Max wasteland, seeing all this shit happen?
Although, you know, nobody other than the driver would probably see it. You know, kids would be in the back playing Minecraft, the passenger right. would be watching the YouTube, whatnot, scrolling right. Facebook. Yeah.
Exactly.
Later on in their journey, the train was attacked by a band of Lakota before making it to Fort Bridger, Wyoming, where Wyatt met 60-year-old frontiersman Jim Bridger, who taught Wyatt effective fishing techniques.
Eventually, the Earps made it to Colton, California, where they settled down to farm. And Colton is really close to L.A. these days. However, the Earp men were eager to get out of Colton and away from farming, so in 1865, that's what most of them did. Wyatt left with Virgil in June 1865, and they drove freight from Southern California to Salt Lake City, Utah.
Later, they became stagecoach drivers through the dangerous regions of Utah and the Arizona Territory. Wyatt learned to be steady with a gun. After this, Virgil and Wyatt worked for the Union Pacific, where they plowed up land ahead of the crews laying railroad tracks. Wyatt learned to fistfight in the Hell on Wheels camps that followed the rail lines being built. That was a good show, by the way.
That was a great show. I really like the villain, the Norwegian, or the Swede.
Oh, the Swede, yeah.
Yeah, you couldn't kill that guy, and he tried.
Yeah, and he becomes a Mormon somehow, and then uses
right.
the, yeah, it's wild.
And then, of course, Common's character who fought a bear. I was like, whoa, he fought a bear. He's so cool. Everything's upward from here. And then he just goes nuts because he fought a bear and was like, anyway, great show. Y'all should watch it. But back to Wyatt. Eventually, Wyatt started a gig where he traveled to towns in the Southwest and California, betting on fights for gamblers from other towns who could not get away to watch those fights. He guarded the money and also became known for selecting winning fighters.
So Nicholas Earp, their father, moved the family back east to Missouri, and Wyatt was eventually named the Constable of Lamar, Missouri. He was 21 years old. He got married to one, is it Urilla Sutherland?
That's how I'm reading it, yeah.
And that was 1870, and they bought a house together. But a year later, she died of typhoid while pregnant. Wyatt burned their house to the ground while drunk. He left and made his way to Indian Territory and the Oklahoma Territory, where he turned to a life of crime.
So Wyatt was arrested in the Indian Territory and accused of stealing horses. But in the end, the charges didn't stick, and he met his future famous lawman and a good friend of his, Bat Masterson. And they became friends and buffalo hunters together, eventually taking up the lifestyle of professional gamblers as well.
Wyatt and Bat traveled to Kansas, where both would start to become famous for their gunslinging ways. In Ellsworth, Kansas, Wyatt disarmed well-known shootist Ben Thompson while walking calmly up to him and his double-barrel shotgun and saying he'd surely be killed if he didn't lay down his gun. Thompson agreed. In 1874, he became a lawman in Wichita, but eventually ended up in Dodge City, Kansas, in April of 1876 to join his younger brother, Morgan.
The rest of the Earps joined them for a time in Dodge, where Wyatt was appointed deputy marshal in May of 1876. But, you know, come September of that year, there was had been a gold rush to the Deadwood area of South Dakota that was on the Great Sioux Reservation. He and Morgan, you know, ski-daddled Dodge, and they went to pan for gold in the Deadwood area. But what they ended up doing was hiring men to chop bundles of wood, I would imagine, on claims that they bought, and then they would cord it together and then sell it in the bundles. And he made upward of $5,000, which he used, you know, to move on somewhere else.
A lot of people couldn't make money in the mines, so they did stuff like that.
Right, yeah.
Wood, yeah. Morgan and Wyatt left Deadwood and went to Abilene, Kansas, not Texas, where Wyatt and Morgan supposedly briefly met Wild Bill Hickok at the Alamo Saloon. Wyatt sitting in the chair Wild Bill had just vacated, where he played an extra lucky game of cards. After Kansas, the two Earp brothers made their way to Fort Griffin, Texas.
It's funny, though, that, like, you know, I looked this up and they're like, yeah, it was Kansas, Abilene, Kansas, but yet they were in a saloon called the Alamo. You know, I love that. I think Wild Bill's my favorite of all the legends other than Doc Holliday, but you know, if I can find a way to link that dude to Idaho, we will. But It was while at Fort Griffin that Wyatt met the tuberculosis-afflicted dentist from Georgia, John Henry Holliday, but his friends called him Doc. The men would, go their separate ways, you know, but before Doc basically would catch up with Wyatt, he stabbed a guy at Fort Griffin, a fellow, gambler who he had been playing faro with. And so a mob was going to lynch Doc.
However, Doc's romantic partner and part-time prostitute, Big Nose Kate, lit a building on fire, as you do. Right. While the mob battled the blaze, Kate procured two horses, saved Doc, and they followed Wyatt to Dodge City, where Wyatt had taken the vacant post of deputy marshal after Bat Masterson invited him to town to replace his brother Ed after he had been gunned down removing the guns from a drunken cowboy entering town.
In Dodge, a group of drunk and aggressive cowboys surrounded Wyatt, and they were harassing him and also threatening to shoot him with cocked and loaded revolvers. Doc Holliday came to his aid with a large revolver in his hand and yelling out insults as he confronted them. Wyatt took this opportunity, you know, when they were distracted, to pull his pistols. And the two armed men herded the drunks into the jailhouse. And Wyatt never forgot this about how Doc came and helped him. And he held him in high esteem afterward.
But Wyatt became increasingly famous and hooked up with one Celia Ann Blaylock, commonly known as Maddie Blaylock, who was a working prostitute. She reformed her ways, quote unquote, after traveling around and being a seasonal lawman for years. Wyatt and Maddie ended up in Tombstone, Arizona territory on December 1st, 1879.
And just real quick, by seasonal lawman, you know, he was in cow towns, right? So like he had been later, you know, and off and on in Fort Worth and, you know, Dodge, Kansas, especially. And so, you know, the cattlemen would be out, and then I think the winter months, it wouldn't be so busy, and then his job was definitely a little bit more dangerous then, and so he had lots to do when it wasn't cow herding season. I'm not sure, ranching season. I don't know what you call it, but so by the time he made it to Tombstone, Wyatt was already famous. And he was known for his accuracy with a gun and his fearlessness in dangerous situations, as well as his no-bullshit attitude. But it was in Tombstone that he became a legend, alongside Doc Holliday. You've seen Tombstone, I'd imagine, Jeff.
Mark, I'll be your Huckleberry.
Oh, Johnny Ringo. Oh, wait, that'd be me in this situation, right?
I guess so, yeah. Yeah.
Doc has so many great lines in that movie.
He does. Classic. Yeah.
I mean, I'll be your Huckleberry. Or my favorite is when he's, you know, I think one of the scenes where he's about to draw and he's like, say when, you know, God. The fact that Val Kilmer never won anything for that award, or maybe he had, or that, that movie, it's one of my favorite performances of all time. But
he definitely played that role very well. Yeah.
Right, I know, but
almost better than he did Batman. Almost.
Oh, damn! I mean, there's no better Batman than Val Kilmer. You know that poor guy who's like, "Why did I do that movie?" He was like, he had all these awesome roles. He's like, "Why did?" Because he didn't know it was going to be shit. Yeah. You know, you had cool Tim Burton Batmans, right? Yeah.
Anyway. He didn't know about the nipples on the bat suit yet.
Oh, you got to have nipples on the bat suit, don't you? I don't know. Do you have like bat balls on the bottom? Anyway, for the sake of time, as we talk about bat nipples and balls, I will summarize what most know about Wyatt Earp, and Doc Holliday and his family. But, after the Earps and Doc had moved to town, they quickly fell into conflict with the gang they call the Cowboys, right? Of the Arizona territory. And they were led by a man named Curly Bill Brocious. And his gang was feared because of the enforcer by the name of Johnny Ringo, you know, and let's just say in the movie and in life, shit gets bad. And then it gets worse when Wyatt becomes the marshal, because Curly Bill had shot down, Marshal Fred White. And so, Basically, Tombstone had a rule that you had to leave your gun on the outside of town and check them in kind of thing. But the cowboys didn't respect the rule and they wore their guns. And so eventually, because of this, Wyatt hears that, you know, Ike Clanton, his brother, I think Billy and the McLowrys are down at the OK Corral, and they have their guns, right? And not listening to the laws of the town. And so Wyatt, along with his brother Virgil, see, Virgil's a badass. He's an old school lawman, you know. Morgan, like the other brothers are really badasses too. That's just Wyatt is such a badass that they are overshadowed by his badassness. That's history right there, though. But, you know, but anyway, Virgil and Wyatt and Morgan all go down to the OK Corral, and Doc goes with them. And I can imagine the best poster ever, you know, with them, like Sam Elliott, you know, Bill Paxton, Val Kilmer, and Kurt Russell all walking down the street, you know, and Doc has the shotgun and the stained shirt. Anyway, if you're youngins, listen to this, watch that freaking movie, one of the greatest Westerns of all time. But I digress. You know, and so they go down to where Tom and Frank McLowry were, as well as Billy Clanton and then Ike. And then they just kind of started shooting, right? And it was a 30-second long shootout, basically. They're just blasting away, but I bet that 30 seconds felt like an eternity. Ike Clanton, who said he wasn't armed, people claim that he was, but he ran up to Wyatt and begged for his life, and Wyatt basically yelled, like, you know, get to fighting or get away. And so Ike got away. And so after the shootout was over, everybody but Ike on the opposing side, the Cowboys, were killed. So Tom and Frank McLowry and Billy Clanton was shot. And Wyatt was the only one that was unscathed. You know, I think everybody else had grazing injuries, but nothing too serious. Soon after that, in retaliation, Morgan is playing pool along with his brothers, or his brother Wyatt, and he's shot in the back through a window of a saloon, and he dies in that saloon. They said it wasn't on a pool table, but maybe it was, but in the book I read, it wasn't. And anyway, and then later at that same time, Virgil is shot in the left arm, and he would never regain the use of his left arm, but he lives. And so Wyatt, Warner, plus Doc, and some other known gunslingers like Turkey something Jack, they're all really good gunslingers in their own right. They are basically deputized, and they go and hunt down the remaining Cowboys in this famous vendetta ride of like 1881, 82. And so that's, you know, a good part of the movie is them chasing after these guys. And so, you know, there's this great scene where, you know, Wyatt is escorting his brother's body to Tucson. From then it'll go to California to be buried. But anyway, he shoots one of the guys that are responsible for the shooting. And then they finally track down Curly Bill Brocious. And there's a shootout at some springs in the territory, Arizona territory. And Wyatt stands out in the middle of a river. And this is in the movie, but he did stand his ground in real, and he shoots Curly Bill almost in half with a large shotgun. And that's why, you know, Curly had had a sawed off gun, right? Not Wyatt. He had a fully extended barrel, and he almost cut that dude in half. So kids, don't shave down your barrels of your guns. Okay. Keep them as they are. And basically, you know, after this is done, there's one guy left to kill, although this isn't historically true. But Doc Holliday, as the movie says, kills Johnny Ringo, the fastest gun of the Cowboys, because only Doc was fast enough to beat him. And Wyatt goes out there in the movie like he's going to do it, and he finds Doc had already killed Johnny Ringo. And that's that great line, I think, where he goes, doesn't he go, say when? Isn't that when he says that bit? Anyway, it gets my blood boiling. I love that scene. So good. But anyway, Johnny dies. And a bit later, you know, you see Doc in a very touching scene. He dying with his boots off in a bed. And he was like, I'll be damned, you know, because he dies of TB. That's why many say that he was so risky in his behavior, is that he basically thought he was going to die. So what the hell? I'm just going to do all this craziness. And so he did. But, you know, Wyatt goes on with his life, and he was only like 33, 34. But anyway, he becomes common law wife. He starts up with Josephine Marcus, who's an actress and kind of a well-to-do person from San Francisco. And she becomes his common law wife. And he left Maddie, his first common law wife, because, well, at least in the movie, she's addicted to opium. I don't know what it was in real life. I didn't look into it. But that's basically the legend of Wyatt Earp right there.
And this has been movie time with Mark.
Right. But, you know, that's basically, there's so much more, obviously, to that story, but we don't talk about it because it didn't happen in Idaho, but there was so much going on there. And it was right after this, you know, that that he becomes a legend. So
there's actually, what's that? Legends of the West podcast is really good. And he did a whole a series on the Tombstone shootout and all this.
Oh, yeah. I listened to his six-parter on Custer's Last Stand. It was really well done. Anyway, yeah, you should listen to that podcast.
He's got a great voice.
Right.
Anyway, so that's where the famous story leaves off. But Wyatt was only like 34 years old after the Vendetta riot in 1882, and he had his whole life ahead of him. After becoming a future legend of the West, Wyatt and Josie made their way to Idaho Territory in 1884. Intending to head up the Coeur d'Alene River to the boomtown of Eagle City in the Bitterroot Mountains.
And as we said, prospector Andrew Pritchard discovered a sizable quantity of gold there in April of 1882. And soon after word got out, miners began to trickle into Eagle City, some coming in from Montana and others from Idaho. Those that came in from the Idaho Territory traveled from Coeur d'Alene, the city that is, and they took a steamership from the city across Lake Coeur d'Alene, towards the mouth of the Coeur d'Alene River, and then they'd travel up the river to the Cataldo Mission, and from there, they'd climb up into the Bitterroots via several trails, and in Wyatt's case, they would eventually take the Evolution Trail, named after Andrew Pritchard's mine, the Evolution Mine.
Wyatt and Josie heard about this strike while living in Fort Worth, Texas, as he was sitting early one morning after a long night of gambling in the White Elephant Saloon, when he read in the paper that miners were streaming into the Bitterroots and cleaning up more than $100 a day on average, which is pretty dang good for the mines.
Yeah, and on January 21st, 1884, the Earps passed through Granger, Wyoming, and into the Idaho Territory, where their train stopped in Pocatello. And then it continued up north to Garrison Junction, Montana, where the Earps changed trains and headed for Missoula, where James Earp was living. James met them at the train station, and after discussing the chances awaiting them in Eagle City, James decided he'd travel with Wyatt and Josie, leaving his sick wife, Bessie, on her own. She was too sick to make the trip over the mountains, but in his defense, they wanted her to come with them, but they just didn't know how harsh it was going to be up there, and so in the end, she didn't make the trip.
So the trio set off from Missoula on a Northern Pacific train bound for Rathdrum, Idaho. After arriving in Rathdrum, the Earps took a stagecoach southbound to Coeur d'Alene City. While on the train, the Earps had started talking to another passenger by the name of Jack Enright. Jack's partners, Daniel Ferguson and Alfred Holman, were riding with him, and they all three were on their way to Eagle City as well.
James informed the men of the best routes to take up to the pass over the Bitterroots and into the mountain gorge within which Eagle City sat. They knew of the Earps and had heard of Wyatt's exploits, and they proposed to be their travel companions. I think they would probably be super pumped to be traveling with Wyatt. You know, say you got in a problem, you know, it is good to have a friend like him that's handy in a pinch.
I wonder how many guns he had on him at this time.
Yeah, I don't know, man. He seems to always have like a couple of pistols. They said that he would wear them up underneath, like, his, not at his waist, but up underneath his arms, right? Under his coat. And then a lot of times he was riding with a Winchester or a shotgun.
After arriving in Coeur d'Alene at 10 a.m. on January 25th, 1884, the Earps and their new friends found a booming town with construction going on all around them. They got out of the coach on Sherman Street right in front of the Dividend Saloon. Wyatt walked into the saloon and found a bar in a 20-foot by 50-foot room with a red-hot stove, two billiard tables, and a large chunk of gold bearing quartz being displayed on the bar in a glass case.
And this was essentially PR, right? Because a lot of the businessmen controlled interests in other parts of the business, and so the saloon keeper that I didn't really add to the script was selling tickets at the same time and telling them where to go to get it. And so you have these huge chunks of ore with gold in it, you know, display, and you're like, hey, look at this. You should get these, you know, tickets up there. And so it was a well-run operation, but the bar was filled to the brim with soldiers, townsfolk, and hopeful miners all talking about the possibilities hiding just under the earth in the mountains. Wyatt asked the bartender when steamships were leaving, and the barkeep said that they weren't leaving until the morning because everything was running slow due to the ice forming on the lake and river.
The steamship Amelia Wheaton was leaving early the next morning, and that would take them close to the Cataldo Mission, from which they could supply the services of guide Sam Hayes, a packer who ran strings of horses up the Evolution Trail and over the Bitterroots into Eagle City.
The Earps spent the night at the Hotel D Landing and bought their tickets at Webster's Trading House. Both establishments were constructed around where the Coeur d'Alene Hotel and Resort sit nowadays. The town consisted at that time of framed wooden structures, some stone and brick buildings, not too many, and the rest was shacks, shanties, and tents. And the Earps basically walked around town, and then they crashed out at their hotel, and it'd be a while before they had a comfortable bed.
In the morning, they took a chilly ride on the Amelia Wheaton. The paddle boat got mired in some gathering ice near the mouth of the Coeur d'Alene River, but they eventually proceeded to the landing below Cataldo. They grabbed their packs and hiked up the hill up to the church, now the oldest building in Idaho, but then is about 30 years old. The journey across the lake had taken 7 hours.
Yikes. At the mission, the Earps found a working commune essentially filled with cattle, horses, a mill, gardens, cabins, and some refined houses as well. And they met the guide, Sam Hayes, and he told everyone, "My name is Sam Hayes, and I run a string of saddle horses from Evolution to Eagle City. It's 25 miles from here to Evolution and about 24 miles from there on over the Evolution Trail to Eagle. In the morning, we'll be leaving here in wagons for Evolution, but we'll have to leave at first light in order to make it there by dark. We'll spend tomorrow night at Evolution and go on over the trail into Eagle City the next day. There are 30 saddle horses at Evolution that we can use for the trip to Eagle. If you want to ride, the cost is $6 a head for the whole trip. If you're hungry, meals are 50 cents.
There were tents gathered around the rolling field surrounding the mission that travelers could sleep in. Wyatt and family ate a meal of river trout, beans, and black coffee before heading to bed. They'd eat loads of trout in the coming months. The next morning, on January 27, 1884, a large group of travelers headed out. Only some mounted on horses. Those who couldn't pay for a ride walked. And I should probably add, Mark, a lot of these miners and prospectors at the time chose to travel in early winter just so they could be to the mines first. They wanted to beat out the competition to get there. And that sounds like this is what the Wyatt Earp and Company are doing.
Right. That is what they're doing, right? It's better to... You know, and they had the Earps had more means to ride comfortably even in winter, but you know, sometimes, as you'll see, it wasn't possible. But yeah, that's true. A lot of hardship now for comfort later. But yeah, the lucky travelers in the wagons crossed the Coeur d'Alene River 12 times before reaching the Evolution Feeding Station, as the establishment was called. This, you know, kind of rustic, you know, halfway stop. In the journey, possessed a saloon, a corral, and perhaps 20 or so tents for the passengers to sleep in. And they were like communal tents. And these people had traveled from dawn till dusk and then some, and they were very exhausted. So, Josie ate her trout and beans, and then they crashed. She crashed in everything that she had. Basically, she dressed in everything she had. Wyatt stayed up and chatted at the saloon for a little bit, but then he too crashed, preparing for the exhausting trek through the snow that they were about to undertake.
At sunup, they all lined up in single file on their horses and started up the trail, ascending the first 1,000 feet up the steep trail to the first ridge. They traveled 9 miles, nearly straight up, as a test of endurance only the extreme wilds of the Old West could offer. The horses had to maneuver around roots, rocks, and boulders, and trees, while also climbing up a supremely steep trail in the snow. The trail paralleled steep cliffs and hillsides at times, and packs loosened and fell off the horses, taking precious time to repack. They did not want to be stuck at the top of the pass come night.
And finally, they arrived at the top of the mountain and the horses could rest. They were exhausted by constantly breaking through the snow and then having to break back out. They finally descended 9 miles on the opposite side of the hill, where they stopped at a beaver creek and they camped for the night. And they were all too exhausted to continue. The next morning, they started down the mountain again and they crossed Pritchard Creek, and that's the one that lines Eagle City. And so they saw the lights up ahead in the snowy winter gloom because it was starting to become evening again. And so, you know, it'd been a long couple days, well, several days of travel.
Eagle City was just two streets, Pritchard and Eagle, with a few side alleys. However, shacks lined Pritchard Creek for miles, and mining claims and cabins were all over the mountains above. Stumps filled the town because the town site had literally been hacked out of the forest. As it was winter, the streets were lined with walls of snow that had been shoveled from the streets, with doors carved into the snow walls where establishments or houses stood.
And crime was a common occurrence around the town and on the claims above. On November 27th, for instance, of 1883, one Newt Thomas woke to hear someone digging through his sluice boxes, or it's slice boxes. What is it? Sluice boxes?
Sluice box.
It's always like, is that thing actually pronounced the way it's used? But
if you watch, what's that show with the guys from Oregon that go up to Alaska to mine? They talk about sluice boxes a lot.
But anyway, when he heard this digging going through his sluice boxes, Newt stepped outside with a shotgun and he fired into the back of a robber. He was using fine grain shot, though, for the robber's sake. He didn't kill the man, but he left a permanent mark on his backside for sure. But the man's name was O'Brien, and he'd actually been robbing claims around Eagle City for a while.
The townsfolk felt that O'Brien had better vacate town quickly, and they told him as much. But as far as any other repercussions went, they figured a back full of buckshot was good enough. Miner's law was basically vigilante law. You either face the lash, you flee, or you die.
Yeah, simple. The Earps had slept their first night in a communal tent, but the next day they went about finding a cabin to rent, as did James. They had money to spend, so they rented a cabin with two different stoves. One was for cooking, and one was only for heating the place. And this was a real luxury, though it might not seem by today's standards.
Fancy.
Right.
As the Earps navigated Eagle City that first morning, they noticed that the secluded gorge and the gulches running up on both sides in the mountains were full of smoke from all the fires burning in the homes, establishments, and up on individual claims. The streets teemed with miners entering or leaving town. Some pulled toboggans loaded with tents, tools, clothes, furniture, and whatever else they needed to make a go of it.
When mining was slow or non-existent due to the snow, Wyatt and James dealt cards and faro, making a living off what they knew, gambling. Josie began singing at an establishment, and then later multiple establishments as they popped up, where the sex-starved miners were basically only too happy to pay for a song or two. And their favorite saloon to work was one they called the Axion Saloon. It was basically a large tent with a gable roof, a rough hand-sewn log floor, and a similarly rough stage. And there were chairs and card or faro tables provided all around.
Violence was the constant companion of most mining towns, and it was no different in Eagle City. Under the shadowy lamps of the Action Saloon sat inebriated men, some of them the rough and quick-to-anger sort of men. One man, who was in fact one of the men they had befriended on the train to Rathdrum, Idaho, cold-bloodedly shot a man named Oregon John to death for merely placing his foot on the bottom of his chair. Daniel Ferguson could not win a hand all night, and after too much drinking and too much losing, he noticed Oregon John had placed his foot on his chair. John was considered a, quote, bum, and was the pariah of the town, and Daniel thought he had been to blame for his night of bad luck. Daniel pulled out his .45 caliber Colt revolver and shot John point blank in the chest, lighting the poor man's shirt alight and blowing his seated form back off the chair.
When Oregon John got up off the floor, I'm just kidding, he was dead. but what is really messed up is that, you know, nobody did anything. Ferguson went back to his cards, and as it was made clear in the papers, since John was thought of so poorly, not a finger was lifted to punish his killer. And he, like others to die in the Bitterroots, was buried up on the mountain in the settlement's cemetery.
Is that still there? Is it still accessible?
Eagle, yeah, there is a. I was looking at the old Google Earth today, and I was finding there's like a gorge, right? And it starts in Murray, Idaho, or somewhere around there. And then you can go up towards some of the old mining settlements, like, there's one called Delta and Pritchard, but on the way to those, there's the one Eagle. It's just called Eagle now. And so that's why sometimes people will be like, whoa, you know, Wyatt Earp was an eagle. And I'm like, no, man, no, he was not. Eagle wasn't an eagle then. Anyway, you know what my point is. But yeah, so now they just call it Eagle.
The people who did nothing included Wyatt Earp, who was playing cards at another table. There was no law established in the town yet, and the man was despised by all, so the ex-lawman and avenger simply shook his head.
After having been involved with the crimes of men for so long and now living high in the mountains, when Wyatt had lived in the flatlands his whole life, he must have felt that he was living in a different world apart from his previous life. Later, when Josie asked if he wanted to go to Tombstone, this is sometime later, maybe several years, but she asked if he wanted to go back to Tombstone to reclaim some land and a house that was being disputed there. He said, no, leave it. You know, I don't want to live that life anymore. I would imagine he felt bad for the man, Oregon John. But, you know, I could also understand him not wanting to kill anymore, get involved in killings.
That doesn't mean Wyatt didn't involve himself in some disputes, however. Andrew Pritchard, the very man who started the stampede to Eagle City, had been staking out 20-acre claims for a year by 1884, except they were for his friends who had not yet made the journey to town to claim them themselves. Many of the other miners thought this was bullshit. They started staking claims of their own on top of the claims Pritchard had been making.
Wyatt had run into some old mining buddies he had once known in Deadwood at the Action Saloon, and they thought Pritchard was full of shit and that Wyatt shared their views on the matter. Wyatt and his partners, the guys from the train to Raftrim, including Daniel Ferguson, Alfred Holman, and Jack Enright, had joined together to form a land syndicate, as they called it. But later that night that, you know, Wyatt had met the guys from Deadwood, the town voted in what they called a drunken vote to make him their Kootenai County Deputy Sheriff, though many claimed Eagle City was actually in Shoshone County.
That's Kootenai County, Mark. Kootenai.
Yeah, didn't I say Kootenai?
Sure.
Well, I did. I said Kootenai County, right?
Yeah, we got a message on, I think, Reddit about that already. So let's.
Right, and then my wife, who was actually from Coeur d'Alene, she was like, yeah, it's Kootenai. I was like, okay. But the person who responded, or at least indicated this, was super nice and respectful. Yeah, they were. And I appreciate it. I told them, thank you very much.
That's the messages we like.
Right. Boise. Just kidding. I love to say that. Z, boy, Z. Jeff. Anyway, go on. That sorry.
So annoying. Wyatt's and the land syndicate's opinions on staking mining claims aligned with local law stating it was illegal to file claims by proxy for those outside of the mining region. Yet federal law stated multiple claims might be made and in proxy if a claimant filed for at least 20 acres placer land and legally held said land by doing a minimum amount of work on it each year. So you could stake a proxy claim, but you had to work on it, and that would make it yours, I guess.
Right. And so somebody had to work on it, you know, like it had to be proved that it was being worked on, I guess. It didn't necessarily have to be yours. Right. So
this basically allowed, you know, rich mine investors from, say, New York, pay other people to go work the mine itself while they're, you know, back sitting in New York, sitting there smoking their cigars and whatnot. So they're still making money while the men on the ground who wanted to own and actually do the work could not.
This was the beginning of the Gilded Age when robber barons flourished and the masses of the laboring poor had shit. But anyway, You know, I wonder why so many people sometimes hate the rich. And I'm not saying they're all like that. But sadly, in the long run, the federal government sided with these rich assholes instead of the miners that had the money and were actually on the site where they could work. But this matter remained in question for a long time before any resolution was found, at least on the ground in Eagle City. Really, the history of Eagle City is one of a rapid decline. And so it declined too quickly, really, for the, you know, matter to be totally figured out in Eagle City. But Murray, a town that is still there, popped up, you know, circa 1884, 85, just like 3 miles down Pritchard Creek.
Now, there were some deadly disputes over mining claims in Eagle City. Wyatt was actually involved in one of these dangerous confrontations his business partner, Jack Enright, had actually initially engaged in. As spring had sprung, hundreds of miners began to arrive every day to find their claims had been jumped. Disputes popped up all over the mountains around town.
Wyatt had filed for the Eagle Creek placer claim on April 2nd, 1884, and had begun working it with his brother James. He and his partners had started to dispute another claim at the same time, however, and the other group of men that they were at odds with were equally stubborn and battle-tested. A man named Fay Buzzard had claimed ownership of a lot that Wyatt and his partners said they had purchased from a guy named Philip Wyman. Buzzard was building a log hotel on the lot when Jack Enright showed up and told him to get off their property. Well, Buzzard put a shotgun in front of his face in reply. Because Enright was unarmed, he did not shoot. Enright vowed to return, but Buzzard failed to take him seriously.
Enright returned with his business partners, who were all heavily armed with repeating rifles and revolvers. Wyatt was not among them at this point, but Buzzard was a tough old, you know, Buzzard, I guess, who had spent time in Boulder, California, and knew his way around a gun. He was not frightened by this show of force. His men rallied around him, and the group set up firing positions behind the log structure they had been building. Before Buzzard could shoot at his attackers shot at him.
Buzzard jumped up on a part of a log connected to the hotel he had been building, and he started firing his twin revolvers, making his opponents run for cover. He then ducked back down, and a long-range firefight ensued between Buzzard and his men behind the log wall and Enright's men all hiding behind stumps and firing at a vigorous pace. Enright and his men started to advance forward one man at a time while the others covered them.
Wyatt and James heard all the commotion and ran towards the sounds of the battle. By this time, Buzzard and his men had retreated from the log hotel and into a cabin farther down the claim. All the parties involved had members receive holes through their hats or coats. Finally, however, the Earp brothers arrived and stepped out right between the two group of heavily armed and still firing men.
Wyatt and James joked vocally about the poor marksmanship on display and urged both groups to lay down their arms and find a peaceful way to solve the dispute. Enright and Buzzard had a drink together afterwards, and both really were upright men by those days time and times standards, but they did come to terms. Buzzard eventually turned over his claim for some dust or nuggets, I suspect, and I never could find out, and Wyatt and company got the claim. The funny thing is that Wyatt and company also bought another lot from Fay Buzzard on Eagle Street inside the town. It was where Wyatt erected a large tent he had also purchased off Buzzard for $2,500. It stood 40 feet high and 50 feet across. And the tent had pinewood floors, a pinewood stage, tables, chairs, and a bar. Wyatt and James started a dance hall called the White Elephant.
The Earps had been buying up lots of small claims in a bid to find a winner, and Wyatt thought they might do better preying on the vices of the miners, and so they did. Calamity Jane came to town as well in the later part of the winter. She frequented all the saloons, and she must have gone inside the giant tent dance hall. I did not find out if she ever met Wyatt, but there's a good chance that they met. Who knows? We'll have to look into it.
But the Eagle City Stampede wasn't the bonanza everybody had read about, and it took real money and equipment to mine some of the claims, while others were just plain busts. Wyatt, Josie, and James eventually left Eagle City, though they lasted through the summer. Before leaving, Wyatt was sued by Andrew Pritchard over a claim Wyatt had jumped. It actually turned out that the law saw that he had actually jumped the claim because Andy won the ruling in June. There's not much more to the story, you know, Wyatt was in a situation where his last act basically is the deputy sheriff is that he was arrested a guy named Dan Ferguson who shot a guy named Thomas Steele on the main street of Eagle on Eagle Street, I think. And basically Thomas Steele had been trying to get the attentions of a prostitute one night in a saloon. And she wouldn't go and she was bored and she wanted to keep drinking. She eventually stumbled out into the street where it had been raining heavily and she just falls down in the street and says she's going to sleep. Thomas wanted to take her home for his, you know, lustful passions. And she's just like, leave me here. I'm going to sleep here. And so he started slapping her in the face. And so Dan Ferguson and the saloon keeper were watching this and they both ran to her to aid her. And, what ended up happening is Thomas started pistol whipping Dan Ferguson. And so Ferguson pulled out his pistols and shot at him a couple times and he fell down in the street dead. And so he went up to Wyatt's cabin, knocked on the door and was, you know, looking for the deputy marshal and so, or sheriff. And so Wyatt comes out and says, I heard the fracas or whatever. He says, stay here. He handed over Wyatt was handed his guns, basically Dan's guns. And he walks down, looks at the crime scene, talks to a few of the witnesses. The Shoshone County sheriff shows up because there's some question of where Eagle City actually lie. But anyway, they go and Dan Ferguson, basically Wyatt gives him the option to stay for trial. But word gets out that the trial is fixed because of a crowd that was friends with Thomas Steele. And Thomas Steele was working for a powerful mining faction in the area. And so Dan wasn't going to get a fair trial. And so what ended up happening is he had run away. And so there was like a trick of kind of media back then where they like said, oh, a new trial can be had. It's going to be a fair trial and all this. And so Wyatt had to warn Dan that this was all a ruse. And so he went to wire office. What do you call that? You know, the teep, 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 things that they use to like send messages.
The telegraph.
Telegraph office. Jeez, I sound like. The telegraph operator was a friend of Thomas Steele's, you know, group. And so he said, I'm going to go to hell before I do that. And Wyatt threatened him, but the small, wily little guy ran off before Wyatt could grab him. And so this is funny, but instead he knew he couldn't catch him. And so Wyatt picks up a large rock and throws it at the guy's head and knocks him out. And then he pulls the guy's, you know, unconscious body back into the telegraph office. And when he woke up, he made him type the message out as he wanted it, warning him. And so anyway, he was never really tried. And so he went some, Dan Ferguson went off somewhere else, but that was just, there were other murders and things that he kind of was involved in. Cause there's lots of killing, but, you know, this one was funny that he just chucked this rock at this dude's head, pulls him back in. When he wakes up, he's sitting in his chair and Wyatt's like, do it.
Yeah.
But you know, that's Wyatt Earp, you know? And so the story basically is that as of September, his brother goes back to Missoula. His wife dies, you know, shortly after, like a year later or so. James Earp, his wife. And then Josie and Wyatt eventually make it down to El Paso, Texas. And, you know, Wyatt lived until January 13th, 1929. And I know that Josie also died in 1929 as well. But you know, the thing about Wyatt in this case that I find interesting is that he's a deputy sheriff and he always seemed to be a lawman, but he also did his thing where he's, you know, a faro and poker dealer and he's living the saloon life. But he's living the life of a, you know, I'd say median range income, mining prospector, you know, and he's doing his best. And that's the story of Idaho, especially these high mountain boom towns and rustic camps that, you know, are really cool. We both love to go find the remnants of these things. You know, he's living what a lot of people in Idaho and the West, but Idaho especially for us, lived, you know. You go up into the unknown of the mountains and you go build a freaking cabin and exist on a mountain and dig in the earth, you know. And that's what Wyatt tried to do.
Like so many thousands of other people that made it or didn't make a successful run of it. You know, I don't know a lot about the Coeur d'Alene mining rush. So this was interesting in that regard to me. You know, I'm pretty studied up on the initial gold rushes in Idaho, but the Coeur d'Alene rush was later on in the 1880s. So it's pretty interesting to learn about that.
Right. I mean, this was the first major kind of like, Pritchard's strike was the first like kind of like filed claim in what became the Silver Valley kind of area and the Coeur d'Alene mining region. But, you know, I forget the name of the actual town, but just after they, you know, the Earps left and stuff, it wasn't long before they, someone hit it big. And I forget which mine it was, but it was like the big one, you know. And Murray was fed, and then they found all these large mines, you know, and it became the largest mining district in the world, you know, and they're still mining there, you know, it's not like it was, but, you know, obviously all this history came out after that, you know, you have Wallace up there, Burke, Idaho, right, Jim, you know, these great towns where a lot of violence happened, a lot of prostitution, it was the old and it was the Wild West. And I love it up there. It's so interesting.
Yeah, definitely something I need to go check out more. I remember I took a trip up to the Coeur d'Alene area. Actually, my dad took, we did a family trip up there once. And then I went with my grandmother in her 1929 Ford Model A. That was quite
Holy
a drive.
Holy crap.
Yeah, we almost died like three times on that trip.
You know, when you're taking something back there that's period and like actually matches the history, that's kind of scary, dude.
Yeah. It was a fun trip, but we were coming back. We went out, I think, to St. Mary's, and then we were coming back around the lake, and there was this hill, and it kind of goes down into there's kind of a touristy area right there, that like ice cream shops, but like people walk back and forth across the street. So we were coming down the hill, and the kingpin on the brakes went out. And so we're gaining speed. My grandma's trying to brake and brake and nothing's happening. And then she ended up like having to put it over into the side of the road. And we stopped on top of this rock. Fortunately, nothing was damaged in the Model A, and they were able to put a new kingpin in it right there, then and there, and we were able to go on. But of course you only have a lap belt because that's been added into the car later because the car didn't have seatbelts. But yeah, that's my Coeur d'Alene story I always tell. I almost died in an old car.
Jeez, that sounds kind of creepy. But so I was looking through the book that I read, which the book that I read, you know, it's a well done, I'd say local history, regional history book, but it was called Wyatt Earp and the Coeur d'Alene Gold, Stampede to Idaho Territory by Jerry Dolph and Arthur Randall. But they used a lot of great source material. They used a lot of newspapers and census stuff and letters and diaries and then, you know, all sorts of autobiographies, a lot of good sources. You know, I looked at some of these articles as well and then some information on the town. So my sources were, you know, that kind of stuff. But this says that, you know, shortly after Murray was established and all those miners left in 1885, that it would only be like a year or so two later, and this might not be right, but when Noah Kellogg stumbled across what would become the largest lead and silver mine, the Bunker Hill Mine, and that would be one of the ones that turned this area into the largest mining region in the world. Yeah.
Wasn't it his donkey that found the mine? Isn't that the story?
Yes, he called like Jackass Pass or something like that because in honor of the donkey. Right.
Crazy side bits of these stories.
He better got that donkey some silver studded, diamond studded horseshoes or something. Or donkey hooves. But yeah, I really like this because because it's just, it kind of separates Wyatt Earp, his life from like this legendary period until, you know, he went on to live a pretty, what would by my standards be a remarkable life after he became a legend, you know. And I haven't looked in because I didn't have time to see what he did after. But I know he became like, you know, well known in Hollywood and stuff, and some early actors in their first movies like really loved Wyatt Earp, and he was a star. You know, he lived so long and stuff. A lot of his friends died younger, you know. Some of the guys that were like, I haven't heard of, but were really known for being gunslingers, died much earlier. A lot of the lawmen that Wyatt had rode with, and there's so many stories we didn't include. So if people that love Wyatt Earp are like, hey, you missed this and this and this, it's like, it would have been 25 hours long if we would have done everything. But a lot of the lawmen that he was a part of died too. I mean, you can count several occasions where he just stood out in the middle of gunfire and like was calm, you know. And that's pretty amazing that he didn't die.
Definitely a crazy, wild, wild, wiki wiki wild life he led. So,
and he had a badass stash. Well, all those dudes had badass stashes, you know. Right, he could rock it. Stash.
Yeah,
right.
All right, so. So, Mark, we're going to take a 2-week break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about a lady who actually helped fire off the gold rushes in Idaho, and they say that she helped turn the tide of the Civil War. So we're going to talk about her next time.
Radio. Radio. That sounds good, Jeff.
All right.
Check you later. Well,
that will say, what'd they say in the Old West?
Adios.
Peace. I don't know. All right.
Yeah, I don't know. Later.
If you want to get a hold of us, send an email to info@idahistory.com. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Ida History. You can visit us on the web at idahistory.com. Ida History would like to thank our listeners, sponsors, and contributors. If you want to know how you can become a contributor, go to idahistory.com/podcast. Please consider giving us a rating and review on your podcast app. I'm Tom Hart, and this is Devil's County.